Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Joining me as usual in the studios of CBS Interactive, Mumbrella Deputy Editor Camille Alacon.
Hello.
Scott Rodia, PR agency House Party.
Hi, Tim.
And our guest today, Marnie Cordell, editor of news and political website New Matilda.
Hi there.
Also coming up today,
The Punch turns one and closes in on Crikey.
Tourism Australia unveils its new ad with the all singing There's Nothing Like Australia jingle.
In TV, the 7pm project hits the 1 million mark, and The Circle finally starts to deliver for 10. Plus, a new host for The X Factor, another young talent.
Jetstar ramps up his ad sales strategy and introduces the iPad as its latest in-flight entertainment platform. We turn first to Marnie, editor of news and political website New Matilda, which, as you may have read in the last few days, is due to close its doors on June the 25th. Launched a little bit over 5 years ago in 2004, it positioned itself as Australia's answer to intelligent news coverage, analysis and satire, which arguably wasn't previously there. But in a letter published on its website last week, Marnie told her readers the site has simply run out of money. Marnie, it's funny how quickly this has become quite a big story, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been all over the internet.
And it must be, you know, I had a look at your traffic as well. It's kind of ironic that it takes the fact that that perhaps you're not going to be around for very much longer to suddenly see that surge in traffic as well.
Yeah, sure. Comparing it to April, we have gone up quite a bit. We actually had a bit of a dip in April, so the months before that we're getting quite good traffic as well.
What led you to where you are now?
The decision to close.
Yes.
The current owner bought it in 2007 and predicted that it would be able to break even in sort of 3 or 4 years.
And at that stage it was on a subscription model.
It was. He made the decision in the middle of that year to drop subscriptions and thought that he'd be able to make enough revenue from advertising to keep it going.
As a lot of people were thinking at the time.
Yeah,
online
exactly.
Advertising's going okay, bigger audience, bigger story to tell the advertisers.
Yeah. So we made that decision for two reasons, because actually the main reason was so that we could open the site up and see how our readership would increase. And in those 3 years, our readership has actually doubled each year when you look at the stats for the whole year.
How many readers did you have towards the end there, your average kind of thing?
Yeah, at the moment it's 211.
Yeah, sort of a couple of thousand on any given day, isn't it?
Yeah, so about the same as The Punch.
Yeah, give or maybe a little behind that, which is probably a bit further ahead. But I guess the thing is, to me, the bit that makes sense in opening up is if you want to be a site where debate happens, you've got to make it easy for the debate to happen. I mean,
exactly.
Do you think if it had stuck with the subs model, do you think actually you'd be any better off now if you'd gone down that route?
I think opening up has allowed people to realise that, well, for starters, that we're quite a different website from when we started. So it's allowed people to see that we've matured and improved and, you know, there's a lot of great writers there now. And if we hadn't done that, I think we wouldn't have reached that audience. If we, you know, all of our content was closed or even half of it was closed. I think it does put people off discovering a website at the outset. But I think now that we've started to build that audience and we obviously have quite a big following and a loyal following, I think subscriptions actually ironically could probably actually work for us now.
And the story of the site itself, I mean, you weren't there quite from the beginning, but you've been with it for most of its history. What was its original aim?
It was started by John Menadue, who worked in Gough Whitlam's government. It was during the Howard government, and he was disappointed with the way that the media was responding to the Howard government and thought that it was failing in certain areas and wanted to start a website that basically stepped into that what he saw as a space that wasn't being filled. So critical voices, critical political voices at that point.
And from your point of view, you joined as associate editor, was that your original?
Yeah, that's right. I started about a year after it started, and I was associate editor for 2.5 years. And then I became the editor in December 2007.
And how did you develop it in that time?
We launched a new website a couple of months after I started as editor. So really the website you see now is the website that, you know, I've been involved in shaping and building. I've brought on regular writers, so Ben Altham and Ben Pobgy. I've encouraged them to become regular people, and that's been very successful. I think a big part of our following is because of their work and us fostering that talent. And we just have, I mean, we're a lot more well-known than we were, so we just have a lot more professional writers wanting to contribute.
And what next? What do you think will happen?
With the website, we've had a few people interested in possibly investing in it. The main response, I mean, it's been incredible how many people have said, but, you know, don't go, I'll subscribe, I'll donate. And we're really very appreciative of that support. It's been actually much bigger than we thought. But at this point, we would still need someone to step in the interim and invest some money in it if we were to think about going down that path. So give us some time to change our business model.
I guess the problem almost is, well, you've got this uncertainty. You know, people have to start thinking about their own plans and their own jobs and all of those things. So if something doesn't happen quickly, then it's not going to happen at all.
Exactly, yep. A couple of people are speaking to my boss about it, but, you know, we're all thinking about other plans and that needs to be a priority too because it's very short notice.
Marnie, I know that you obviously are from the editorial side, but in terms of the switch from subscription to an open model and wanting to drive advertising revenue, what happened? Why was the site not able to attract the advertisers onto it, especially considering that you have increased your traffic?
That's a good question. I mean, it's increased slowly over the last 3 years, but just not at the rate that we thought. And I think, as Tim mentioned, 3 years ago, people were thinking they could make a go at, you know, if you have the readers, the advertising will come. And that really has changed quite significantly in the last 3 years. My boss, I guess, the owner of the business, was, you know, he actually was inclined to invest money in it rather than take donations from people, for example. And I think New Matilda is the kind of thing that people would actually donate, you know, small or medium amounts of money to if they were able to, because it's something that people, there's a community around it and people feel quite invested in it.
How big was the sales team?
We have a general manager and an advertising person who, the advertising person's actually part-time.
Right. And how many journalists?
There are three editorial staff.
I wonder, you see, I saw the story come up that you were closing, I wondered whether it's that old thing of, you know, I'm a journalist, I'm all for a sort of journalistic utopia where we don't really invest too much in the sales, but I almost wonder whether there was that disproportion, it needed a bigger sales effort, for instance.
Sure, yep.
I just find
I think probably a failing.
I mean, coming from my point of view, coming to Australia, I just find Australians are so apathetic about politics that most of them probably wouldn't go there. I mean, that's a personal thing, opinion that I've noticed. That
empathetic or apathetic?
Apathetic.
Okay.
They don't really give a damn about politics, really. And the latest polls show that they don't even care about any of the politicians, which is totally understandable, to be honest.
I suppose that is it's an interesting question, is what sort of proportion of Australia's public would be interested, do you think, in what New Matilda had to say?
I think that's probably true for, you know, a majority of Australians, but there's definitely a very engaged section of the population that is. And I don't think that New Matilda was ever going to appeal to someone who had no interest in politics. I mean, we weren't even trying to target that audience. So,
what did you think about the name itself? I think it was the right choice.
I wasn't involved in coming up with it. I think, yeah, I mean, there was confusion at the beginning because there was actually a Matilda magazine in the 80s and people were sort of saying, well, if you're New Matilda, then how are you connected to that? That sank under libel action, I think.
Yeah.
It wasn't around for long. But, yeah, I mean, I think it could have been better.
What about you, Tim? Do you agree with the name? Do you think you're sold on the name? Or?
Well, see, it worked for me, but I come in the context of someone who's been in the country for less than 4 years, so I wasn't aware of old Matilda. You know, Matilda to me was the more obvious reference. So for me, it worked as an A.
Yeah.
There was actually discussion about changing it when the owner bought it in 2007.
What was on the long list? Give us some examples.
Oh, I don't remember. No. The fine print, I think, at some point. The decision was made that, you know, people know it already and yeah. we should build on that awareness.
See, the fine print would make you go, well, yeah, it's about topics I want to...
I think it's good that
New Matilda works in that it brands itself as an Australian voice as opposed to the punch or the drum where it's very generic.
Yeah.
So this is an Australian voice talking about, you know, Australian politics. So for me, it kind of actually does work.
Now, speaking, it
sounds like a girls' magazine to me. So that's maybe for me because I'm from a different country, but New Matilda just sounds like a girls' magazine.
What, like Dolly or Frankie or something?
Yeah, you know, it's not. I'm not connecting with it at all, the name. And the name is one of the most important things.
Anyway, I'm glad that Camille mentions The Punch. Speaking of The Punch,
nice segue.
The Punch celebrated its first birthday this week, and so far seems to be holding its own. According to data from Nielsen Market Intelligence, it's reaching not that many fewer browsers than Crikey, which has been around for a while. So in May, The Punch was averaging a little bit over 12,000 daily unique daily visitors to Crikey's 15,000 or so. And there have been some months in the previous year when it actually was the other way around and The Punch had its nose ahead of Crikey. I guess these guys play in the same space that you do. Which are your favourites among the kind of the online commentary sites? Where do you find yourself looking? And if you weren't at work, are there any that you would actually choose to look at on your day off?
Two different questions. I do read. I read Crikey. I read it pretty much every day. The Punch. When I have looked at it, I've been. I guess because I'm an editor, I see typos and bad punctuation and things. I think their standards could be higher, so I've been sort of a bit distracted by that.
Have you read Umbrella?
Yeah, we're very guilty of typos on Umbrella.
Oh, so are we, don't worry. It happens when you're publishing quickly.
Breaking news, Barney.
What's that?
It's breaking news. So we're quick.
Got to get it up.
Not always accurate.
No. I read Crikey. I read The Drum a bit.
Which is the ABC's relatively Trump. Recently launched.
I didn't read Unleashed as much, actually. I think also because, well, often some of the articles that we knock back turn up on these outlets. So I think,
that's
you know, you
amazing,
see the same
it?
Names yes. popping up and you sort of go, well, I know what that person's saying because, you know, so I read it last week when they submitted it to us.
Are you saying that The Drum is an outlet for rejected New Matilda
I wasn't
items?
Talking about The Drum. I was talking about other outlets at that point.
Just no comment.
No,
forward.
I think it happens when you know you're relying on a freelance pool, a limited sure. freelance yeah. pool. It happens.
I got to admit, I drop in and out of The Punch occasionally, but they wrote an article the other week, commentary piece about how the World Cup is sexist because the female World Cup doesn't take place at the same time, and I thought it was one of the worst, not just the worst written articles, but a complete pile of crap.
But you've reacted to it.
Yeah.
You've remembered
yeah,
it. You've talked about it.
Yeah,
but that's
A,
what the punch
I've not
is
commented
about.
On it, and B,
it
I'm never going to
go
back to the site, probably.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose
that's, you know, I think that doesn't work. If I've decided that you've just pissed me off enough that I don't really want to go back to your site, that's a bad thing.
I suppose one of the things that I wonder about with The Punch is whether its heritage is very much newspaper journalists, where the typical role of the columnist is often to outrage. And the habit is for the readers to tune in, you know, to open up the paper and see what that idiot's been saying this week. So I see that provocative nature in the
I get that in a newspaper, but online, I don't agree with that. I think writing for the sake of causing outrage is not the way you should be writing. You should be writing because you feel that. But this guy, the way it was written, I don't think he actually felt that way. I think he was just trying to be controversial to be controversial. What pissed me off.
The Punch is very much... comment. There's no deeper analysis.
No,
there.
I know.
Whereas New Matilda doesn't actually publish much comment. We publish analysis based on new information or, you know, drawing together information that is already
interesting.
Out there.
That one of your leads this week is about government advertising, which is it's a commentary piece. Yeah, and you kind of your contributor points to Kevin Rudd's expose as Satan's rent boy. Please explain.
We should probably point out that's written by our regular satire writer.
I thought it was really interesting, actually. It was just basically talking about how beige government advertising is because it caters for the swinging voter. So it's kind of tailoring their advertising to the lowest common denominator. Is that right?
Yeah. Ben Pobjee is our resident satirist, so he gets a sort of free thought, reign well, I thought than it, a lot of our other writers.
Yeah.
you thought it was news.
I thought it was really interesting. I actually quite enjoyed it.
And lots of people mistake him for being serious.
No, I thought it was hilarious. But the thing is, though, was he serious about this line? He talked about neighbours. So he's talking about pitching to the lowest common denominator, as we discussed. And he said, it's the same problem that saw neighbours dumbed down from the whip-smart, innovative slice of social realism it once was. That is a joke,
Well, that was when... do you not remember when Kylie
made... Charlene used to,
you know, it was a commentary on a woman making her way in a man's world as she put on her...
She was a mechanic.
She was a mechanic, that's right.
Loved it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, but the issue itself, though, is an interesting one. I mean, I think we talked about it probably on this podcast last week, this whole thing that as the election approaches, despite all of the promises, suddenly the government is investing in reminding the public everything it's getting up to.
Yeah.
Didn't Rudd hasn't come out that the whole mining thing recently turned out that
super tax.
The advertising aspect of it was came up. He said that it was they came up with the idea after liberals came up with their thing, but it actually turns the mining.
You sound so well informed.
Hold on,
Scott.
Right?
Let me do this again. You're really nailing this one down.
Hold on, let me do this again. So Kevin Rudd's government
take two, Scott.
Decided to do
We're
some.
We're not
ads,
editing out your.
No, that's fine. Did some ads to combat the mining groups advertising to say that the tax is wrong. However, it came out that the ads were created before the mining organisation come up with their ads. So they actually, and Kevin Rudd admitted last year that they wouldn't be investing money in those kind of ads. And yet, turned around, they said they wouldn't do it without approval from one of the ombudsmen or whatever.
Yeah, they gave themselves the exemption.
Yeah, and then they've just turned themselves and lied again. I'm so sick of the politics in this country at the moment. God.
Sorry, politician lying. Oh, no.
Yeah, but do you know what? If you're going to lie, don't get caught out. And if you get caught out, raise your hand. They haven't raised their hands.
Or be like Tony Abbott and just say that you lie.
Yeah, that's even worse, though. Jeez, now we can't trust our word.
Certainly one thing that has struck me, though, is that actually there's not been maybe as much noise as you might think from the media about these, let's call them backflips. No, I don't think that's the reason. Who benefits when the government advertises? Where does that money get spent? Television. You know, there have been weeks in the last two or three weeks where the number one biggest spender in primetime has been the government. Looking at last week's...
Are they investing in your site yet, Tim?
Well, I don't think that latte-sipping ad wankers are quite the target audience for the government.
Which reminds me, your pop-up ad today annoyed me.
Oh, I see. You have a problem with advertising now, do you?
I dropped on the scent. I was like...
I think it's time to move on. And more to the point, time to thank Marnie very much for joining us and good luck with hopefully keeping the site on its feet. Yeah.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Marnie.
Next up, we'll have a sing-song.
There's nothing like it, is there? No. There's nothing like the sunrise, that first wave of the day.
The trip along the coastline.
It's right across the bay.
There's nothing like this ancient place.
The sunset from a camel.
This organism.
This bitter ball.
Oh, this dark-billed mammal.
Da 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 da.
Da 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 da.
Da 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 da.
Friends down there.
There's nothing like this bear.
That's not a bear.
There's nothing like this giant shrub.
There's your arm.
This bird.
There's nothing like this hairy thing to bounce around in her.
There's nothing like Australia. There's nothing like Australia.
There's nothing like this
wondrous land from Darwin to the Strait.
There's nothing like the people here.
Well, as we've just heard, Tourism Australia has finally released its new TV ad after the disastrous Where the Bloody Hell Are You, Lara Bingle campaign. The all-singing ad by DDB, featuring sweeping Australian landscapes, has attracted a lot of attention, and not all for good reasons. Tim, what does the Mickey Mouse Club, Aeroplane Jelly, Happy Little Vegemites and the Discovery Channel have to do with the ad?
There's a lot. There's a lot to untangle from everything you've just said there. Firstly, I think I'm going to take issue with you on Where the Bloody Hell Are You being a disaster.
They said it was a disaster.
Well, that's the thing. Yes, the current government says that the previous government's ad was a disaster. My sort of feeling is, are you sure it was a total disaster? You know, it got much talked about. It got big publicity in the UK.
But Tourism Australia said it wasn't the best campaign that they launched, not just the government.
Well, but mainly the tourism minister. And if you're sitting next to the tourism minister who's just described it as a rolled gold disaster and you get asked, you're not going to contradict the boss. So anyway, but that's by the by. So, the reference to Mickey Mouse Club, MICKEY from the Mouseketeers, and also the Discovery Channel, this has probably been one of our most commented threads of all time. I would say that 90% of people or more hate the ad. Some of them just because, you know, it seems a bit out of tune and a bit ochre. But others point out it sounds a bit like the Mouseketeers tune. Others point out that the Discovery Channel had a very similar style of ad. Structurally, it started with two people talking to each other, saying, "Hey, isn't this cool?" or something along those lines, and then breaking into a line by line song. So, certainly lots of similarities. But I would say that none of this matters. If it does its job, which is to make people aware of what Australia's got going for it, or remind them, then does it matter if it's original? No.
I agree with you.
Does it deserve to win awards? No, but it's fit for purpose.
Does it make me want to visit Australia?
Well, you're already here.
But I know, but that's my point. I it didn't make me. When I watched it, I was like, I felt very meh towards the whole thing.
But do you not think that's maybe because you're close enough to the country now?
Yeah, no,
because your perception is different.
No, because I sent it to my mates in the UK and asked them their opinions because I knew we were going to talk about this today.
And what did they say?
They all thought it was crap.
What reasons did they give?
So one of them said it felt too convoluted, that there was too much packed into it. He said, you know, I've got a 2 week holiday I can do, and that just looked like if I want to do everything, then I need a year or 2 years or something like that. Which he said to me then, said, well, I think it's designed for backpackers.
Interesting, backpackers. For me, it felt as though it had all the scenes, the kangaroo koalas and the opera house. It had all the scenes that people know Australia for, so it was kind of like a tick those boxes. So it was like a box ticking exercise. However, the song just sounded a bit cheap and nasty.
Yeah, it kind of took it back to the 80s.
It was just a bit old. It didn't have a new feel to it. However, I think that perhaps that's what people overseas expect from Australia, and so that's what they got.
And I guess we won't actually know for months or years to come. Next, we turn to TV. So in television, it's been yet another good week for Ten, with the 7pm project cracking for the first time the 1 million mark, and its daytime talk show The Circle finally stabilising after what was a massively shaky start in the ratings. Camille, it's been another big week for Ten, mainly driven by MasterChef.
Well, MasterChef, yeah, and on Wednesday night it had a really, really big night. It was almost 2 million.
It was right teetering, wasn't it? Just under 2 million, which is, I think, the first, apart from like a big final, it's the first time it's got that close on
a
weeknight.
It's quite big. I think the last big one that we reported on was about 1.85. So this is quite a big. It was a big night for them, but also because I think it was the first day this year and the year to date that Ten actually led in the ratings in terms of channel share. So in terms of 10:30 p.m. Ratings, Ten had about 26.6% share, ahead of 9, which was 23.8, and 7, 23.6.
So a very big week for
Very big week and very 10. Big night for 10. And also The Circle, so that was launched in February this year.
What do you call a good rating for The Circle, though?
Well, last year, its replacement from last year was 9am with David and Kim, and they averaged 68,000. And so this was the replacement, this all-women chat show, similar to The View, the US, the very successful US The View chat show. This week it actually settled on 80,000.
Okay, so it's getting its nose ahead. It is much better than it.
Yeah, because it had lows of 50,000, so there was a bit of worry. It was teetering on the border of, is this going to be a success?
Still some way behind 7.
Oh, 7's going to be far and away the lead for who knows however long, but like it's more than double on 7 and ahead of Carrie Anne as well. So
now, speaking of 7 have revealed the host for its new talent show, The X Factor. Camille.
Matthew Newton, controversial.
Yeah, a bit of a wild card that one.
Like that pause your temp. Yeah.
I'm just thinking back to how many comments I had to edit for legal reasons on that particular story.
Do you want to talk about them now?
No, let's not. So we have the lineup, we have the judges. I've noticed actually in some of the, not in Sydney, but looking on YouTube in some states, they've actually been using Simon Cowell, the creator of The X Factor, in the UK, and he's about to do The X Factor in the US as well, as one of the kind of faces fronting the ads, just little recorders of saying, hey, it's going to be good. So I'm starting to suspect we may see him pop up in Australia for a guest episode or something, doing a little bit of the judging. So I think we're gonna see a cameo from Cowell at some point.
A cameo from Cowell,
yes.
That should be exciting.
Up next, Jetstar, the Qantas-owned airline, gets in on the iPad phenomenon.
Now, with the iPad launching in Australia last week, brands have been quick to jump on the bandwagon, and not just the publishers. Tim, what's Jetstar up to?
Yeah, now Jetstar are good at PR.
Yes, they are.
That's the thing that we need to say up front. Jetstar are very good at PR. So, for instance, they were the first people to announce that they were going to be doing a 3D ad, when the sports broadcasts were on. And to me, that was partly, it was just an opportunist thing to get themselves talked about. It wasn't about reaching that small audience. It was being seen there to do interesting things. So that's kind of what I'm seeing Jetstar up to this time, announcing that they're going to be hiring iPads to passengers for $10 a pop. Now, maybe it'll be a great little service, and maybe it'll take off, but I kind of think the main reason they're doing it is because, again, it's a great little bit of PR and it's a good way of differentiating the airline. Would you invest $10 a flight, Scott, in an iPad?
Not when I have one.
Well, clearly, yes. We've joined the space age this week, by the way. Scott is reading his script off his new iPad.
There you go. It works well.
If you didn't have one.
If I didn't have one, it depends what applications are on it, because ultimately that's, it's a device, but it's a device that stands on what's on it.
Yeah, it'll be movies and TV shows and music.
Yeah, if they're streaming games, using Air Video or something like that, then yeah, it means you've got a selection of whatever you want from their server. You can just sit and grab. But as Tim brought up earlier on, if I'm reading a book on it, or if I'm watching a movie, for the first 15 minutes of flight and for the last 15 minutes of flight, they usually say switch off all electronic devices. So that's. Well, what do you do then? Are they going to say, no, actually, you can leave your iPads on during that time? Just switch on to flight mode? But they won't, because they say, you can't have a Game Boy on anything. You can't have anything even without a transmitter on it. So I'm not quite sure what they'll do, because if it's a short flight, you're just paying $10 and you get it for like 20 minutes. You're going to be a bit pissed off.
Yeah, it's interesting that they're doing it as a trial on domestic flights, because they do other flights now, don't they, internationally.
And I'm going to speak up in favour of Scott's iPad, by the way, because I just lost the last page of my script, so I can share his iPad, which is even better.
I've got to admit, I'm thinking about selling my MacBook Pro at the moment because of this iPad. I got it because I'm a gadget freak, but it's actually changed the way I'm working, which is quite impressive.
And have you? And obviously, in the publishing side, you've got The Australian. As we know, The Australian is all about the iPad.
I think they mentioned it, actually.
Once or 300 times at all. And obviously, Fairfax, Sydney Morning Herald, The Age, and the Sports and Style, they're launching something. Tim, you wrote about a bit of a preview about the wrap.
Yes, it was quite interesting. On the day after the iPad launch, so The Australian was there right from the beginning. Initially, actually, the votes from the customers were not terribly positive. They were giving it about 3 out of 5, one of the issues being ads popping up all the time. I thought you were going to come in there, Scott, having an issue with ads popping up.
They annoy the crap out of me, and the Australian one really annoyed me, but yeah, I stopped using it, just deleted it from my phone.
And you got the sense that the consumer resistance is, I've just paid $5 for this, why am I also being served ads?
Mm-hmm.
But then very briefly, up popped the Sydney Morning Herald and the Age's application for a few hours on the Saturday night. Hasn't officially launched yet, so it's obviously some sort of trial. And seemed to be relatively well received from the person who tipped us off about it. Yep. Although I've since seen other comments from others who saw it who were less impressed.
Yeah, look, the funny thing is, people who buy iPhone and iPad apps are used to the fact that they can get some for free, but it's usually got ads in it. So, right, that's the standard. So if you buy a video game on it, if you download it for free, it's got ads. If you pay the extra $2, it comes without ads. So people have got used to this fact. If you're paying for it, then the ad shouldn't be there. The only difference is, say, the Wired magazine app that was half a gig download had was actually a full magazine and you had to flick by the adverts, but all the ads were set up in a way that you could interact with them. They either could have videos to play, they would link you to the website, that kind of stuff, which is quite interesting. But on the Australian one, it just felt like they were shoving stuff down our throat, and I just paid for that, which annoyed me.
Arguably early days, first iteration, so we'll have to
I think they're trying to set the precedent that you still pay and you still get ads, just like newspapers, but, well, yeah, I wasn't sold.
Coming up, another controversial ad gets the chop from primetime. Now, every so often, an ad crops up that a lot would say deserves the boot. This was certainly one of the debates that went on Umbrella this week. A TV ad for the self-proclaimed world's largest infidelity website, Ashley Madison, got quite a few viewers up in arms when it was aired last Sunday during Nine's Underbelly 3. Camille, what went on?
Well, a lot went on, actually. Now, this
happily,
ad...
mainly on the comment thread of Mumbrella, I was delighted to see.
Yeah, I mean, this ad actually launched mid-May during the footy show, the Friday Night Footy, and there were no complaints. It wasn't until it was aired in the last break of Underbelly last Sunday that suddenly there were about 100 complaints that last we heard earlier this week. Basically, people saying that it's inappropriate for the time slot. So it was an MA classification, which Free TV classified it as MA. And then
which means it can be run pretty much.
It can be run post 9 p.m. So Underbelly went until about 9:35, 9:32, and so it was the last break. So basically the ad features people, sorry, a man and a woman getting undressed.
But it's not very raunchy, is it? Compared to what was going on in Underbelly, there was a lot less flesh showing.
Well, this was the argument by some of our posters in that, okay, it's you're showing two people in bed and then the copy says this couple is married but not with each other. So promoting, you know, infidelity, and you can go to this website and actually just cheat on your partner. People were, you know, up in arms about the fact that, you know, it's promoting infidelity, it's inappropriate. And the thing is, people are also arguing that, yes, it's an Underbelly. There's sex, drug-taking, violence rife in this show.
Yeah, but your Christian morality people hate cheating. God damn it, they hate it. They don't mind people getting their heads chopped off, but they're fine with cheating. They just get up in arms over cheating. And I bet you, I can tell you this, right? The majority of people that complained
Christians.
Will be Christians or religious people. And do you know what? Stop complaining. That's all I'm going to say. If you've got a problem with it, don't watch it. Switch it off. Oh, sorry.
Well, if you're watching
chair.
A show like Underbelly, I find it really hard to understand why those people would be complaining about an ad like this if you're watching a show like Underbelly.
So they can get up in the morning and rage against the show and
do you,
the ads.
Do you think there's a PR element? Do you think some of it was manufactured outrage by the website itself?
Look, absolutely, because think about it as well. Frontier Media is the agency that handles the website, and you know, with a client like this, a website about for infidelity, you know, obviously it's going to get people, you know, angry and pissed off.
And there is a PR agency involved as well.
Yeah.
Yes, and they certainly made sure that we were aware that it had been taken off the air.
So they obviously were making the most of the situation. You know, if it's going to be a contentious...
The question is, were they manufacturing the situation? Do you think those phone calls of complaint were coming from the PR agency?
Official complaints must come in by writing, should they not? Is that the way it is?
Yeah, I believe there are PR agencies that can write, though.
You can
really?
Go online now.
Look, I watched that ad and I was like, well. And then I dropped onto the site to look at it. I went, well, do you know what? If consenting adults want to cheat on each other, yeah, go ahead.
And on that piece of wisdom from Scott, that's where we have to leave it for today. We're out of time. Thank you to my co-hosts, Camille Alacon.
Thank you.
And Scott Rohde.
Nay.
And, of course, our earlier guest, Marnie Cordell. Production was by Georgina Pearson. That was the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows.